Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no, how would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast, now available on the Times radio app.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for ways to win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Yo. Technology. What is it all about?
How far do you think it will go? I mean, do we get to the point where it's like, sex is for fun, this is for reproduction?
Yeah, totally. I think that's totally where it's going. I think that it's going to be, I think, much faster than people think, the default way that people choose to have kids.
Hello and welcome to Danny in the Valley, your weekly dispatch from behind the scenes and inside the minds of the top people in tech. This week, we're going to do a little shift, a little gears, and talk about babies. That's right. So, you know, you've been listening to this podcast, I hope, for years. And if you have, you know that Silicon Valley is obsessed with longevity. We've had pretty much everybody in that space on this pod over the years. And there's just a river of money. Many billions of dollars are flowing to startups working on everything from, you know, a single God pill to extend healthy life, to therapies, to reverse aging, others to slow it down, biohackers who are taking off-label drugs and the belief that they will slow down the kind of the process of their minds and bodies getting older, etc. But this week's guest is attacking it from the other end, the very beginning. Noor Siddiqui is the founder and CEO of Orchid, which has developed a way to screen the whole genome of IVF embryos. And the goal is very simply to have the healthiest babies possible. So the screening promises to detect the most subtle to the most obvious genetic abnormalities that raise the risk of virtually anything under the sun, from bipolar disorder to heart disease, cancer to autism, intellectual disability, the list goes on. And as you just heard with that intro quote there, Noor, who she applied, you know, her computer science training at Stanford to fertility and genetics while she was there, her view is that this is the future. This is just the way that people are going to do it. Sex will become entirely recreational because IVF is going to get cheap. Maybe it'll even become subsidized by the state. And whole genome sequencing, or screening rather, will dramatically cut the possibilities that your baby has baked in their genes, something that is going to create a disability or an early death. And one can see, maybe if you squint, that governments could someday pay for all of this. Because just look at what healthcare costs are doing. They're so vast. They're growing. It's either a fifth or a sixth of the U.S. economy alone is just healthcare. And this has the potential to basically cut out a lot of diseases, a lot of suffering, a lot of disability before they even start, by allowing people to choose the healthiest potential embryos. It's the ultimate form of avoidance or early detection, if you will. Theoretically, lots of savings. But as of today, we are super far from that future. It costs about $2,000 per embryo to do this screening, on top of the many tens of thousands of dollars IVF costs. In other words, this is very much an upper crust, first world service. And that raises all kinds of concerns, just around society, social, socioeconomic dynamics. And what's more, folks in the field say you can even select for eye color, skin tone, even IQ. It's a very, very slippery slope. Now, to be clear, ORCID is not doing that. But, you know, there are other countries where they might be like, hey, we just want to, you know, breed super babies. But ORCID is just a fascinating business because they're just starting to gain some traction, you know, gain momentum in the States. And actually spoke to one of their patients, a couple with no obvious problems conceiving, but they, based here in the Bay Area, they're both quantitatively minded, and the possibility of increasing their chances of a healthy baby just made this kind of a no-brainer for them. Would it be for you if the price was right? Have a listen to my conversation with Noor of ORCID and let me know what you think. So let's get to it. Enjoy. First of all, thank you for taking the time. I've been watching you guys for like probably a couple of years now. I first came across you guys because I think I know one of your investors, Josh Browder. Is that right?
Oh, cool. That's amazing. Yeah, he's a badass.
Yeah. So Josh has been on the pod several times over the years. I think the first time I met him, he was still living in the old Mark Zuckerberg hacker house back in Palo Alto when he was still at Stanford, or kind of at Stanford.
Oh, cool.
Many years ago.
Yeah, I think that's where we met, actually, was at Stanford. So that's funny. From the very beginning. It's so cool.
Yeah. So before we get into ORCID, which I find completely fascinating, and I think I mentioned to one of your colleagues, we've had Genomic Prediction on the pod as well, who have kind of been in this area for a while also. I'd love to understand how you came to it, or kind of what you were doing leading up to ORCID.
So I think I got really interested in genetics from like a super young age, actually. So my mom has this condition called retinitis pigmentosa. So she got diagnosed with that in her early 30s. So it's a degenerative condition. So you sort of progressively go blind. And that was obviously like a very shocking diagnosis for her to receive. And in the beginning, we didn't even know, you know, what the cause was. We didn't know if it was something that was going to affect, you know, our aunts and uncles, her siblings, us, her kids. So it was like, it was just very scary. And it was something that really stuck with me, because you sort of see someone's life get hijacked where they have so much independence and then they can't drive. And then just like, there's like a sort of a lot of things that us, you know, sighted folks take for granted as making our lives a lot easier and more independent. So that's when I got really interested in genetics, was at super young age. And then when I was at Stanford, I was actually just doing a ton of computer vision and just AI research across a bunch of different domains.
So where did you grow up?
Northern Virginia. So like 30 minutes south of DC. It's like a very, very chill area with a bunch of like government contracting is super common.
Yeah.
And lawyers and it's just a lot of like DC metro area focused things.
Gotcha. Yeah. So then you came out to the West Coast for Stanford. And when were you at Stanford, or when did you start at Stanford?
I was there from 2015 to 2019.
Got you. Okay.
So yeah, I rotated in a ton of labs, and the place where I think some magic happened was I was rotating in a genomics lab, and I was kind of like the computational person, and there was a bunch of biological data that we were getting, and I was building deep learning models to predict transcription factor binding, so helping biologists run fewer experiments.
I see.
I also got exposure to a bunch of genomic data sets where you have people's sequence data paired with their medical record. I was really impressed with the power of these models, where you're able to predict things like heart disease or breast cancer or diabetes, conditions that previously we couldn't quantify the genetic basis of. Now models have gotten a lot better.
So just so I understand, so on that, there were medical records of people who had lived, you know, whatever, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, however long years, paired with their genomic data, and you guys had models that, had you seen that genomic data from day one, you could have predicted, well, your chance of getting breast cancer is X, or Alzheimer's is Y, or whatever it may be.
Yeah, it's a good way of summarizing it. I mean, basically, it's just you have genetic data and then you have labels, right? So the labels are basically, it could be anything as granular as your LDL levels or your blood pressure, or it could be something as vague as sort of a diagnosis that a doctor reached over a couple of years. It could be, you know, what medications they were on, what symptoms they were having. It really just depends on the data set and how granular and how much you trust the codes, or usually like ICD-9 codes, so like what medical billing codes were assigned to this patient. So with all of that data, you can aggregate a disease phenotype however you want, right? Doctors define diseases in different ways. You can take a definition of a disease and then figure out what are the variants that are associated with the disease that are, you know, enriched in the population of people with the disease that are less present in the controls. And then with that, you can quantify genetic predisposition to disease in a way that we weren't able to before because we didn't have that mountain of genetic data paired with medical records. So I thought that was a really powerful tool. And then I ended up teaching a class at Stanford called Frontiers in Reproductive Technology. So I was kind of teaching the computational side, and then I brought in the head of reproductive endocrinology and fertility, so Stanford's top fertility doctor, to teach the clinical side, and then the lead embryologist, the person who runs Stanford's IVF lab, to teach the embryology side. That was kind of a match made in heaven. Those folks ended up being the scientific and medical advisors for ORCID when we got started.
So wait, hold on, just 1 second so I understand. So you were a student, but you're also teaching a class?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so basically as a master's student, I started teaching that class.
I see. Got you. And when you kind of were pulling this class together and pulling those kind of experts in their fields together and also seeing, wow, we kind of have this new waterfront of access to this genomic data and computing capabilities that allow us to basically make sense of them in a way we couldn't before. Was the idea for ORCID already kind of germinating?
Yeah, definitely. I think that the initial ambitions for ORCID were actually, I would say, much, much smaller than what we ended up achieving. But yes, the germination of the idea was definitely there. Probably, I mean, I've been interested in like sort of like fertility and genetics since I was a kid. So there's always that interest, but the actual like exact shape of the product, I don't think was there until towards the end of the class.
And so when did you start ORCID?
So basically I was accepted into a couple of PhD programs, and then I sort of had this decision of, you know, do I want to go do a PhD or do I want to go work on this now? And, you know, basically some of our first investors basically just talked me out of it. They were like, well, you know, in 5 years, the whole ship will have sailed on this problem and you'll have written up some great papers, but you won't actually have built a great company. And I'm really glad and feel very fortunate that, we've been able to, you know, build it. So basically what we did after that was hired some of the best single cell sequencing folks from Stanford. So basically the reason why this problem has been hard is that when you have embryos, so just to like give a super quick summary of IVF, the female partner is on medication for about 10 days to mature eggs from her ovaries, right? So one huge misconception people have is that if you do egg retrievals or IVF, you accelerate menopause, you like bring it closer, right? That's actually not the case. So naturally every month a woman does not lose one egg. She actually loses dozens of eggs, right? So not all of them actually ovulate, right? You only ovulate one egg a month, but actually dozens are actually shed and lost. So what is happening during that medication period is that you're sort of aligning all of those follicles to mature at the same time, and then all those eggs are retrieved. So once those eggs are retrieved, they're fertilized with your partner's sperm, they become embryos, and those embryos grow for about 5 days. And on day 5, 6, and 7 is when the edge of those embryos, so the trophectoderm cells, are sampled and sent to ORCID's lab for analysis. So the thing about those cells is that there's very few of them, right? They're very precious. There's only four or so cells that are sent for analysis compared to, you know, if you spit in a tube or you get a blood draw, there's millions of cells, right? So there's a lot of DNA. So when you have that really, really small amount of DNA, the amount of testing has been really limited because you can't get whole genome data off of that.
Four is not very many, right?
You've got like maybe 5 picograms of DNA per cell. So you're talking about sort of best case 30 picograms. So this is sort of an order of magnitude less DNA than you usually have. So when you have a little bit of DNA, you can usually only get a little result. So basically what it took was sort of the best minds on both the chemistry side. So basically being able to extract and amplify the most DNA from those cells, as well as the best computational folks in order to kind of iterate on both sides of both chemistry and the computational pipeline so that you can get that 100x, that whole genome data, rather than just the tiny fraction that most of their testing evaluates.
Got you. And you mentioned that you hired, you know, some of the kind of the top people in their fields to help you figure this problem out. How did you do that? As somebody who was about to go on to get a PhD and, you know, like had you raised money by that point? Like, how did that all work?
Yeah. So basically I did the fundraise about the end of 2019, 2020. So basically by the time incorporated the company, I'd already kind of built relationships and talked to a lot of those people. And I think people want to work on something that's going to make the history books, right? So I think that, you know, if you say, hey, you can work on this problem and, you know, it'll probably never impact anyone for like 10 years, which is what the opportunity is at a lot of roles, people aren't very excited. yeah, I mean, the thing that's so compelling, I mean, to me, and I think everyone who works at Orkut or is excited about Orkut, is that you're able to help people in sort of this, the most consequential moment of their whole life, right? They're choosing which embryo to transfer, and that has enormous consequences if that embryo has a disease that doesn't get detected. So I think it's just a problem that's, I think, captivated society for, you know, generations. So I don't think it's any credit to me. I think it's been a big prize that everyone's been wanting to focus on. And it's just hard to get that opportunity because it takes investors with guts to want to bet on something like that.
So how much money did you raise, and who backed you? Because obviously you're a student, you're coming out of Stanford, you've never run a company before, and you're trying to do something scientifically that's really, really hard. That feels like a big lift.
Yeah, a lot of really amazing folks backed us. Brian Armstrong from Coinbase, and Wojcicki from 23andMe, Carlos Bustamante, so he's a MacArthur Award-winning geneticist, George Church, one of the leading geneticists as well. A lot of amazing people came out of the woodwork, and we're really excited to jump in and help solve the problem.
Well, it's interesting because I've written a lot about and had a lot of people on the podcast in the kind of longevity world, and there's a lot of enthusiasm and excitement about like the kind of this new age of longevity medicine and geroscience, et cetera, and this idea that we can actually make some real leaps in terms of life expectancy and health span and all that stuff. And this feels like part of that continuum, obviously. You're just starting on the other end. Fair?
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, our mission statement is actually to extend the health span of the next generation, right? So if you are born and you have much, you know, lower likelihood for all of these chronic diseases that typically limit the life of everyone, yeah, you can live a longer life where you can be fortunate enough to have disease hit you 10 years later, which is massive for something like dementia or heart disease. So basically South Asians, for example, we get heart attacks about 10 years earlier. We're way more likely to die from those heart attacks, strokes. So why be stuck with that narrative? Why not, you know, give your child the best chance at mitigating risk for a disease that you know you're predisposed to, whether it's because of your family history or because of your ancestry or, you know, whatever it may be, sort of like leveling the playing field of like, you know, you want your kid to not start behind the starting line of, okay, well, they have to deal with something that wasn't through any, basically just through bad luck, right? That's one of the things that I find really cool about Orkut is sort of like the idea that anyone can make their own luck, right? It doesn't matter what disease you have or your partner has or that runs in your family. It's sort of like, well, you can make the decision to get that data at the earliest possible stage to have the best chance of avoiding it.
So where are you in terms of the technology, the product, its availability? Because it sounds like there's been a lot of things you've had to figure out. And I don't know if this is like now widely available, it's working, it's being used. Like if you give people a sense of kind of like, yeah, where you've got to.
Yeah. So we're at over 40 IVF centers across the country, hundreds of embryos tested, dozens of pregnancies. First baby was born a couple of months ago, and we were able to basically sequence the cord blood. So the baby's DNA compared to the embryo's DNA and show that the concordance was incredibly high, right? So it's sort of, it's not exactly the quality of blood, but it's incredibly close to the quality that you would get from a blood sample, which is just like an amazing accomplishment. So yeah, it just feels really cool to have gotten this, you know, full circle moment from really having this dream and thinking it was amazing, would be an amazing thing to be able to do, to actually being able to deliver it to, you know, families all across the country who have had, you know, heartbreaking situations, right? So one of the first cases that we've done was with a child that had a de novo mutation in a gene called KCNQ2. So that child had severe developmental delay, epilepsy, wasn't expected to be able to walk or talk. And their parents came to us and said, you know, can you sequence our embryos so that we can mitigate the chance that this happens in our next child? And what's significant about a de novo mutation is that even if you sequence the parents, you wouldn't see it. De novo mutation means it's something new, it's spontaneous,
right,
that happens in the embryo. So that's another place where our technology really shines, because we're actually reading the entire genome of the embryo, as opposed to other technologies like genomic prediction or anything else where they're looking at well under 1%. So if you're looking at a really, really small fraction of your DNA, you can only mitigate risk for the small fraction that you're looking at. That's what's been really powerful, and what I think parents and doctors are really excited about.
And so how does it work? So this requires IVF, obviously.
Yeah.
So that's step one. And then you have IVF, say you have, I don't know, five embryos, pick the number.
Yeah.
that day five, day six, day seven, you guys go in, you get a sample from each embryo, they send it to your lab, and you guys are able to analyze the entire genome of this potential person to be?
Yeah, exactly. So there's actually, I would say, some layers to the analysis. So the first step would be chromosomes. So chromosomes, you can kind of think of them as like chapters in a book, right? So you have 23 pairs of chromosomes, 23andMe. So if you have the wrong number of chromosomes, then it's usually not viable. It's not compatible with life. So monosomy one, like one chromosome one, that's going to be a miscarriage. It's not going to be compatible with life, right? There are these rare situations where chromosomal abnormalities actually are compatible with life, right? So Down syndrome, trisomy 21, that's a abnormal number of chromosomes, but it leads to a live birth. So the first step of the analysis is chromosomes. That's something that you can get elsewhere. It doesn't require sort of this deep whole genome analysis. Then we look at something called microduplications and deletions. So these are small extra missing pieces of chromosomes, situations like DeGeorge syndrome. That's so we start detecting that, which other companies can't see because they're too small, they're too subtle. And then we look at monogenic mutations. So monogenic mutations are single genes that can cause disease. So there's hundreds of genes that cause neurodevelopmental disorders like autism or intellectual disability or epilepsy, like kind of that KCNQ2 situation that I was talking about. So we screen for hundreds of genes that cause those developmental delay syndromes. Then we look at birth defects. So there's hundreds of genes that cause heart defects and skeletal defects and unfortunately all sorts of birth defects. And then the third panel on the monogenic side looks at pediatric and adult onset cancers, right? So all of that monogenic screening is very binary in the sense that if you have this mutation, it's this syndrome is associated with it, right? And then the second side of the analysis is the polygenic side, if that kind of makes a bit more sense. Basically, there's this really large report and it has lots of data in it. And then we have a genetic counselor that walks you through each of the results for each of the embryos. So typically people are coming to us because they just want to mitigate the maximum amount of risk. So that's also, I would say, kind of a misconception. People think that IVF is only for people with infertility, but IVF has already been used for 40 years when you know you have a single gene mutation, right? So let's say you know you have Tay-Sachs or cystic fibrosis. Those folks are already, you know, they don't have infertility. They're doing it because they want to prevent their child from having a condition that they know that they have a high likelihood of passing on.
Is this regulated or is it because it's IVF? And then if you're in the IVF clinic, they can say, well, we have this test. You can either pay for it or not. So what is it? What is the kind of regulatory overlay or is there one?
Yeah. So basically all genetic testing, whether it's on blood or saliva or embryos, is regulated as an LDT. So LDT means a laboratory developed test. So that's something the FDA has purview over. The other entities that regulate LDTs are called CLIA and CAP. So those are accreditation bodies where they're at their federal level and the state level. So all those folks, you know, come to labs and they make sure that the validations, the instruments, all of those conform to the standards that would be expected. So they're really looking at analytical validity. So when you say that a specimen has X, does it actually have X?
Right.
So we got those certifications a couple years ago now. And that's like that was like one of the considerations for where we wanted to get set up was basically it's a place where, you know, where there's not like basically a backlog.
Yeah. And how do you see this playing out? So we're in 2024. You've just had this first birth of a fully sequenced embryo last month, was it?
They was born in October.
A couple months ago. So we're still kind of right at the early innings of this. But I'm just wondering what your vision is, you know, 5 years out, 10 years out, 20 years out. We'll talk about America first, because obviously IVF is not cheap. Not everybody has, you know, access to this stuff, but just trying to kind of understand how you see this playing out. Because I'll say, when we got pregnant, you're super excited, but you're also, there's that thing in the back of your mind where you're like, I just need this child to be healthy.
Yeah.
I need this child to be okay and all these tests to come back the way they're supposed to. And it's kind of like very nerve-wracking as well. So I think any parent listening can kind of understand innately the attraction here. But I'm just wondering, how far do you think it will go? I mean, do we get to the point where it's like sex is for fun? This is for reproduction.
Yeah, totally. I think that's totally where it's going. I think that it's going to be, I think much faster than people think, the default way that people choose to have kids. And I think that's because a number of factors. It's actually not just the fact that the orchid exists, right? Women want to have children later, right? The optimal fertile time for a woman to give birth is like 21, right? No one's doing that. You know, the ball has shifted in the other direction. I think the average age of a first-time mother in San Francisco and New York is like 32 or 33, right? A geriatric pregnancy is 35, right? So by definition, by how far we've pushed and prioritized careers, IVF is becoming almost a necessity if you want to have even two or three kids, right? There's secondary infertility is a huge problem. So basically, by virtue of the fact that women are planning their pregnancies many years in advance and on these really long, unforgiving career tracks, I think that it's basically going to become a necessity. And then compared that with the fact that if you conceive without IVF, you're actually putting your child at greater risk, right? Now there's hundreds of conditions that could have been mitigated or totally avoided without prior knowledge, right? I think parents are going to feel guilt that, okay, well, if I had just screened for this ahead of time, then my child wouldn't have this condition, right? So for the situation with my mom, she was actually kind of lucky in the sense that there was a gene therapy that was developed for her condition. It's called Luxturna. It costs $800,000 per eye. It doesn't reverse the blindness, but it just prevents it from progressing. But the worst part about it is that it only treats 5% of people with her condition, right? Most of these Wow. diseases are very genetically heterogeneous, meaning there's lots of different typos that can cause the disease. So there's actually 30 million Americans that have rare disease, right? So that's 10% of the US. But each of the typos, each of the diseases have so many different variants that there's not an economic incentive for any company to try to go and build a gene therapy or do the R&D for it because the markets are by definition under 200,000 people. So it's really kind of shifted to be, well, it's in parents' hands to decide, do they want to mitigate the risk of their child being affected by something, whether it's something minor or something, you know, really catastrophic that would really derail the child's just developmental milestones or things like that.
You say it's kind of shifted now to the parents. I'm sure a lot of people listen to this podcast and this is all news to them. In other words, most people don't even know this is a possibility. And most people don't even think about IVF unless they have to, i.e. unless they are having trouble conceiving. So it feels like, not saying that there's millions of people not using IVF, but it just feels like that shift feels some way off when it's like, no, we're just, you know, we're going to go straight to IVF when we want to have a kid.
Yeah, I mean, we're already seeing it, right? I mean, so, you know, me, I don't have any infertility issue. I tested my embryos. There's lots of women who are doing egg freezing, and there's not any difference between egg freezing and IVF, right? The only difference between egg freezing and IVF is that you decide to fertilize those eggs rather than just freeze them, right? So yeah, a ton of couples are reaching out to us really to do it for disease mitigation already. And, you know, we've done, you know, almost no marketing besides, you know, a handful of podcasts. So yeah, I don't know. It sounds like it might be far off, but I think it just sort of depends on where you sit, right? I mean, how long did the transition take from, you know, home birth to hospital birth, right? And then you sort of see the pendulum swing back a little bit where, okay, well, actually, you know, home births are sort of maybe more exciting for some people. And then how long did it take for once, you know, epidurals were introduced to say, okay, well, actually, I want pain relief during the most painful thing that happens in my life. So I think the speed of technology adoption is correlated to like, what's the pull? What's the strength? What's the benefits, right? So IVF has already done a really good job of becoming normalized over the last 40 years, right? There's not really, at least in major metro cities, there's not really any stigma associated with doing IVF. And I think as the knowledge disseminates of, hey, well, your child could have a, you know, massive reduction in risks that parents are inherently extremely worried about because it not only affects the child's life, but it also affects what's the actual parenting cost, right? If you don't have support, if you don't have resources, it's very difficult to be able to support a child with special needs, right? Especially if you already have a child who already has special needs. So I think if you pair that, for a certain parent, it becomes a no-brainer.
How much does it cost?
It's $2,500 per embryo. So, you know, if you have 10 embryos, it's $25,000. If you have, you know, five embryos, it's half that. So it just depends on the number of embryos. So the number of embryos is really correlated to the age of the woman, usually.
Right.
I would say, like, I think our record number of embryos that we got from a single cycle is like 28 embryos, but that's really high. Usually it's like more the 5 to 10 range.
Right.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
How does this get to be $25 in embryo? Is that possible?
No, I think it's definitely possible. And I mean, you know, sequencing the first human genome costs like, you know, $1 billion. That wasn't too long ago, right? That was only 20 years ago. So that's something that I think is really cool about technology is that at certain scales, you're able to bring the costs down tremendously. So yeah, I mean, a huge component of the cost is just the cost of sequencing, the cost of compute, the cost of analysis, the cost of expert review. So as all of that gets more and more automated, the process can get, you know, more affordable and also the reports are only going to get richer and richer, right? Because more sequencing is also happening, right? And more data is being generated constantly for more and more ancestries and for more and more granular phenotypes or diseases that people are interested in. Yeah, I think that the trend is only going to accelerate. So I would say that the real bottleneck is really on the IVF side, and that's really kind of just inflated.
Well, that's what I was going to say, right? IVF is like a down payment on a house or IVF. You know, it's like, it's so crazily expensive and it often doesn't work. And then you have to try again and spend more money. And it just feels like in terms of financial commitments, it's a very huge deal.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't have to be. I mean, in other countries, it's like a quarter of the cost. So in Spain, you know, you can do an IVF cycle for, I think, $4,000 or $5,000. I think some places even $3,000, right? So the cost has to do with, okay, well, what's the cost of rent in these cities? What's the cost of salaries in these cities, right? We've like artificially constrained the number of REIs. REIs are fertility doctors. The number of those that are minted every year in the U.S. is incredibly small. You don't have to restrict IVF to only be done by those folks. So the cost of IVF, we've already seen, if you just look at different markets, can be, you know, radically lower. So there's not like a, from a first principles perspective, way to not make that more affordable. I mean, if you compare that to, in California, the average cost of a vaginal delivery is around $9,000, like with insurance, right? So, and that's just a vaginal delivery, right? A C-section is, I think, more expensive, depending on, you know, what your insurance does or doesn't cover. So yeah, I think from a cost perspective and from a convenience perspective, I think it could be way, way, way simpler. And then the other thing about success rates is that if it becomes more of a societal trend that, hey, you know, you freeze your eggs, freeze your embryos earlier, the success rates are much higher, right? The reason why the success rates get lower is because, you know, infertility is a natural state for all of us, right? At, you know, 50, you know, women don't have any more eggs, right? It's not possible to conceive. So we already have seen that if you freeze eggs and embryos in younger women, they have the same outcome as when they are older and they implant those embryos as younger women the same age. So it's really about the age of the egg and of the embryo. So I think that what's really great is that we're seeing that so many more women, you know, are basically telling other women, hey, you know, if you are going to have kids by, you know, 25 or 28 or whatever number, it's going to become more difficult with every passing year. So, you know, freeze so that you can, you know, have the optionality for, you know, the number of kids that you want to have later in your life. And I feel really happy that knowledge is being disseminated nowadays.
Are there any guardrails that you guys are putting on around what people can opt for? Because I've spoken to sociologists who are like, you know, getting a bunch of people together who signed this letter or document being like, we need to have an urgent conversation as a society about what we're cool with and what we're not. Because there's one thing around disease prevention, There's another one around IQ optimization or hair color or skin color or whatever it may be. And, you know, you quickly get to this dark place that Gattaca, or this kind of idea of like, we can start breeding like kind of superhumans. And obviously this would start as something that is accessible to people with means. So one, are those fears legitimate? In other words, can the technology actually isolate for some of those things? And two, if so, what is your kind of philosophy on that?
So ORCID's focus is on these really catastrophic earlier late onset diseases. So our focus is fully on health. But I totally agree. I mean, I think that at a fundamental level, it's like a societal conversation that needs to be had of what information do you want parents to have as part of this decision and what information should be censored, right? So in India and in China, they don't allow sex to be reported, right? You can know sex from the chromosomes. They don't allow you to report it, right? So
that's today, because I know obviously China had its one child policy and it had that horrendous effects. But like if you're having a child in China and everybody gets their, you know, their tests at 12 weeks and et cetera. But in other words, if people are like, what is it, a boy or a girl? And you're like, in China, you're like, I don't know. They won't tell me.
So this is for embryo testing specifically.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I actually don't know about what their policy is on in utero testing, but yeah, it's for embryo testing. And then in France, for example, paternity tests are have to be court ordered, right? So you can't get that information because the French society has deemed that that would be, you know,
right.
For whatever reason, they've decided that isn't allowed. So yes, in the US, if society decides that certain attributes shouldn't be reported, then, you know, that's the law of the land. So it's up to the public and, you know, the people to decide what they want and what they don't want.
But right now, is it up to you?
Right now, as far as I understand, there's not like legislation in place about it.
And just on the first part of my question, and I know it was a very long meandering question. So
yeah.
Is the technology capable of, and I'm sure nothing's 100%, but saying, okay, you know, this one looks like it might be a blonde haired dude who's 6'6" and going to be super healthy and very smart. And this person over here looks like he might be 4'6" and maybe not so smart. How granular can it get?
So ORCID's main focus is on diseases and, you know, preventing these like awful syndromes like birth defects or autism or those types of things. So I can't really comment on the value of these other predictors. But yeah, I mean, there's lots of papers that are published online that, you know, folks can check out. I mean, it's been an active area of inquiry for a long time. I mean, almost any attribute has a genetic basis. So in terms of like the variation that you're going to be able to see between siblings, it really depends on the trait. It depends on the data set. It depends on a lot of different factors, but I think we all know that there's a large genetic component to everything, right? From disease to other physical attributes that people might be interested in.
But you guys are just basically about disease prevention.
I mean, it's super powerful, right? I mean, within like a single generation, if, you know, people got excited about this, you could slash incidence rates for sort of every major disease. I mean, each couple that comes to us is just, you know, it's a huge relief for them personally, right? So they, a lot of times, we're worried about whatever condition that they or their partner had, and we're sometimes considering not even having kids because they were so worried about passing it on to a child. So being able to give them, you know, that greater confidence that, hey, you've done the best that science could possibly do today, which is lower the risk for these diseases, is something that I think is super powerful. But yes, I obviously understand people have curiosities about other things as well. It's just that I think you just don't want to threaten this like big prize, right? It's sort of like there's been so much money put into drugs, right? And these drugs, they have, you're sort of leashed to them for life, and they're usually treating symptoms rather than root causes, right? Yeah, I just think it's like really powerful to be able to identify the source of disease at the root and then be able to just take that risk totally off the table. Yeah, it's like a vaccine, but for thousands of conditions at once. I wouldn't want to rock the boat so much that big prize for parents and families everywhere that I think a lot of people are generally pretty excited about. Would be threatened. But I do agree. I think it's like an urgent societal conversation. But how do you feel about it?
I do think there needs to be an urgent societal conversation about it, because I do think, you know, in a way it's similar to almost virtually every technology I write about. Like there's like the latest being AI. This is going to do amazing things for the world, but it's also going to really screw some things up. And it all depends on who has it, and how they choose to use it, and how it is used in one country, and according to their norms, may be very different from how it's used in another country.
you know, again, speaking as a parent, I'm like, if money was not an issue and we were doing IVF, of course I would do it. But it's also just, it's tricky, right? Because it threatens to kind of really draw a super hard line along class. Because if you are a well-to-do San Franciscan techie, or you are somebody in, you know, blue-collar worker in rural Mississippi, I can afford to have a healthy child. And if you're in Mississippi, you can't. And that's hard. And I don't know really how to solve that problem, especially in America, where, as you say, it's like $9,000 to just give birth, which is the most natural thing your body is supposed to do. And you have to pay, you know, these ridiculous amounts of money. I have a whole thing about the American healthcare system.
Not to be too dystopian, but it's already the case that that's happening, right? Because people who are infertile, right? So yep. If you're wealthy, you can afford the treatment, and you know, or you have a cushy job that covers it. And you know, if you're not, then you don't, right? So we're already living in a society where people with means are able to have kids,
for sure.
And people without, right? So it's basically, you know, making it possible for those embryos that already exist to basically transfer the one that's least likely to have disease, which, you know, also is a collective benefit, right? I mean, we're all paying the cost of, you know, these chronic conditions that, you know, we're not able to cure.
It has the potential to kind of exacerbate those differences. But at the same time, it's this is a bad analogy perhaps, but it's like kind of air travel. Like transatlantic air travel used to be for like rich people, and it was like in current dollars, like tens of thousands of dollars. And now if you know, go on Expedia at the right time, you can get a ticket for a few $100 because it's come down. It's become more common. People have accepted it, and there's a whole infrastructure built up around it, et cetera. So these things always start out as accessible to the people who can afford it. But the question is like that path toward kind of equalization.
Yeah, I think there's always, you know, there's plastic surgery and then there's heart surgery, right? And sort of people feel differently. Okay, heart surgery should be covered, but maybe plastic surgery shouldn't, right? And I don't know. I think we just have to take like a hard look at, you know, what are our values as Americans, right? So, I mean, other countries, they cover IVF, you know, fully until you're 44 and, you know, as many attempts as you want, right? Because they really value kids, they really value babies, and they really want to spend money at this time where, you know, there's an urgent need, and we can just decide that, right? I mean, we're a democracy, so we can all just say, hey, this is a amazing technology that shouldn't be only relegated to people with means, and then we can just cover it for everyone. I mean, I think the entire infertility industry would be excited about that, right? They've been lobbying for that for a while. So I would love for ORCID or whole genome sequencing of embryos to be the reason that tips it over the edge of like, well, okay, this isn't just about infertility now. This is, you know, a huge chunk of society could benefit from, you know, mitigating their risk for disease. So I think that there is probably broad and building public support for it. So there's sort of two routes to it being something that's, you know, accessible for everyone. One is the technology, as it scales up, becomes, you know, more and more affordable. And the second side of it is basically just public support, right? It's not that we don't have the dollars. We're currently spending those dollars in, you know, the last week or 2 weeks of life, right? You're in the ER, you're in, you know, the ICU, and, you know, you're on like multiple support systems, and, you know, they're trying to extend your life by a few extra days. And we could just decide as a society that, okay, that's actually not the most important time to spend those healthcare dollars. The more important time is, you know, earlier in your life when you're building a family. So yeah, I think people would be shocked to know how much, you know, what the dollar amount that's actually being spent, you know, during those last couple of days. You had a little glimpse of it when you see this crazy $9,000 delivery bill. But, you know, imagine if it wasn't just that 2 days, right? You're there for 2 weeks or 3 weeks, or you know.
Well, that's why I thought it was interesting when I was looking at your investors. It's like Vitalik Buterin and Brian Armstrong, as you mentioned, both people who have put a lot of money toward longevity. And it was just, to me, it was like, oh, this kind of penny dropped. It was like, they're just approaching the same thing that they're very interested in, but just doing it from the start rather than the end, which is kind of, as you said, it's almost like a kind of a prenatal vaccine in a way. But the other question I had is, does it work? And do we know it works? And the reason I ask is because, again, thinking of as a parent, as a new parent, especially, you're like, you go to the store and there's like 83 strollers and they all have to have like meet certain standards because this is baby stuff and it's all kind of vetted and verified. You're like, this is an $80 stroller.
Mm-hmm.
This other one is 1500. And then there's like every stripe in the middle. And it's like the whole implication is you can get the cheap one. But you're a bad parent if you do that. If you cheap out on this thing that is like going to keep your baby safe, or like, you know, the car seat, same thing. And so, again, the allure of this is so understandable, but it's especially because it is new. And by their very nature, most of the stuff we won't know for decades, whether like, you know, this is actually, you know, so it's a very long experiment, basically. So how do we actually know that this works?
Yeah, so for all of the monogenic screening, you see immediately when the baby's born that they're not affected by those conditions, right? So when babies end up in the NICU, so the neonatal intensive care unit, they're a lot of times they're sequenced, right? So different NICUs have different rates of sort of genetic basis of those diseases, right? So it's anywhere from like 20 to 50%, depending on the NICU, right? So you avoid that, you know, really catastrophic thing from happening, and you sequence the baby and you can see immediately, okay, does the baby have BRCA, sort of a cancer predisposition gene? Does it have any of the genes that are on the panels for autism, for epilepsy, right? So all of the monogenic findings, you'll know immediately upon birth that the baby will be negative. And that's kind of the whole point of these studies of these babies, is sort of saying, okay, look, we have the sequence data from the embryo, and then we're matching it to the sequence data of the baby. And we can see those really subtle alterations, those de novo variants that, you know, no previous technology was able to be high enough resolution to see. We can see, okay, look, we saw them in the embryo, and then we see the same ones in the baby. So for anything that's monogenic, you'll sort of see it immediately. And that testing has already existed in the newborn screening, in so products of conception are basically when you have a miscarriage, you can sequence that tissue and find out, oh, right, was there a subtle alteration that caused that miscarriage? Yeah, basically these panels already exist in the pediatric setting. They already exist in adults for hereditary cancer. So for all of that, you know immediately that the baby's negative. So for any of the genetic risk scores, it is a longer game, right? So for type 1 diabetes, you know, sort of the symptoms start to emerge maybe at age 1 or age 2. So it really just depends on the disease, right? Schizophrenia and bipolar, they're not diagnosed until ages 18 or 20. But the way that we like to counsel or talk about those is it's not like a binary yes or no, do you have it or not? You're really quantifying the genetic component of risk. So I think a really good analogy for that is smoking, right? So if you smoke, you're not guaranteed to get lung cancer. It's not a lung cancer diagnosis. It's saying, hey, you have this risk factor, this modifiable risk factor, and you're choosing to put the risk factor up the highest, right? And something that I think people don't realize about smoking is that if you smoke, you know, 1 to 5 cigarettes per day, at age 80, your chance of getting lung cancer is 8%. So you have a 92% chance of not getting lung cancer. So I'm not advocating smoking, obviously. You should obviously not smoke, because that 8% is still, you know, 15 times or 20 times what the average base rate is, right? But the framing of this is really critical, right? It's what is the baseline risk of the disease, and then how much more or less are you going to get it based on the genetic component of risk? And different diseases have different amounts that they're modifiable by lifestyle factors versus by genetics, right? So something like schizophrenia or bipolar, as far as I understand, there's not many lifestyle choices that you can make to really tilt your odds of getting the disease. For something like heart disease, again, very common in the South Asian population. So even South Asians who eat the best and are the most aggressive at exercise, we still get it earlier, right? So, but it is more modifiable still, right? If you're super high BMI, all of the effects of any cardiovascular condition are going to be much worse. So some things are, you know, the lifestyle factors can dominate, and some things the genetic factors can dominate. So what the genetic risk scores are able to do is you're able to quantify a genetic component of risk that was previously invisible and previously one size fits all, right? So today, what we can see is that you have siblings, and one sibling, you know, develops breast cancer and the other one doesn't, right? So why is that? Is it because one person was exposed to, you know, 100 times as many carcinogens? Probably not. There's probably a genetic component of that. So that's what parents are able to see for the first time, is that they're able to see what is the difference, what is the delta in genetic risk between one embryo and another? And it's not a guarantee that this child isn't going to get the disease. It's, you've minimized the genetic component of the risk to the best of your abilities, but I mean, I don't know, maybe I feel like the canonical example is like Trump, right? Trump had like a 20% chance of winning. Okay, that doesn't mean zero.
Yeah,
I think it's really powerful because, I think it's powerful because I built it because I wanted to use it, right? It's something that, you know, as soon as you see a disease in your family, you want to do anything that you can to prevent, you know, your child from having it. So yeah, I think there is some fear or misconception around, I think, people thinking that if you put a number on it, then you can just clamp it to zero if it's not 95, right? If you have 8% chance of lung cancer is, you know, 20 times the average. You don't want it. You just should not smoke. Everyone should stop smoking, but it's not a free pass. Oh, 92% chance of not getting it by 80, right? So that public health intervention was an amazing intervention, right?
Yeah.
It's like, it was correct to tell people to stop smoking. And I think basically by the same logic, if you're able to move the base rate of your child's risk for disease by any number of points, I think that you have a justification. And for some people, you would say you have a moral obligation to your child to do that. I'm not as strong willed about it. I think that it's really just about more choice. I think that when it comes to having kids, it's like extremely intimate and personal decision. And you know, what I want to do here is basically just give people more choice, right? So there's a lot of people who, like I said, they're worried about having kids to the point where they won't have them at all because of these risks that run in their family. And being able to give them and everyone else who wants the information, the ability to have access to it so they can make this, you know, life-changing decision is something that, yeah, I just think is super powerful and exciting.
Is there a genetic like predisposition for like for being an asshole? You mentioned Trump, but I was just like, you said there's like a marker for everything. I don't know if there's like, oh, this is the aggressive gene or the kind of the shyster gene or whatever. Just like,
that's super funny. No, yeah, who knows what we'll discover in the future, but I think that might be coming down more to mate selection. So choose your partner carefully. Can't help with that.
And is this, when you got all of the, when you got regulatory approval, was that based on like peer-reviewed papers or like, you know, kind of hardcore research that shows at least that kind of undergirds the product you're now selling?
Yeah, so we have some papers out that kind of show our validation. So basically just we've done a ton of work to basically show that, okay, look, we have embryos with all different types of anomalies that have been tested by orthogonal technologies. And, you know, we show that, you know, our sequencing data is sort of on par with blood or saliva, which is, you know, it's amazing. It's a world's first. We're literally the first company in the world to be able to offer that. I mean, it has been offered in the research setting, you know, prior tests, but being able to get it at that really high sensitivity, specificity, and precision and coverage of the genome is something that we're super proud of. And, you know, we keep collecting more data, obviously, and very excited to, you know, keep sharing that with the community. And yeah, the other side of it that I'm really proud of is the actual comprehension, right? Because you're talking about, you know, does it work? And do people understand how it works? And so basically we show people, you know, their results, and then we test them too. We say, okay, you know, do you really understand what this means? Because we don't want them to misinterpret it and say, okay, well, you know, for this thing now I'm guaranteed a healthy baby, right? They understand that, you know, this is a mitigation of risk. It's not zero risk. So that's something else that I've been super proud of is, right, like a lot of times with these things, it's really all about expectations. It's sort of, do you really have a handle? Do you have the framing correct? And I've been really proud of our you know, genetic counseling team to be able to, you know, make sure that parents really understand, you know, even before they do IVF or order the results, that this is what they're signing up for. This is, you know, what we can give them. And then on the other side of it, you know, they understand what they're getting.
Have religious conservatives come for you guys yet? Because I can see them now be like, you're playing God.
Really? Well, why? I mean, it's not any different than IVF. How is it new or different?
I guess you're basically, you're choosing kind of which embryo lives or doesn't live, basically. I mean, it's like all wrapped up in the abortion argument, basically. I don't know what, I haven't spoken to, you know, somebody who's super religious or on the right about their views of IVF, but if life begins at conception, you know, embryos are conceived, right? So there's a bunch of others that you're kind of making the affirmative choice, I don't want those.
Well, you can transfer them at a time where the woman isn't going to get pregnant, right? So it's a little bit similar to sex. It's called compassionate transfer. So basically you can take the embryos that after you've built your family of however many kiddos you want, you can compassionately transfer those back into mom. And, you know, basically because she's not on hormones, they won't implant, but they have a chance of implanting just like, you know, every time, you know, you have fun at home, there's a chance of a pregnancy. So yeah, that's something that's done. But the thing is that, you know, people already choose embryos on the basis of sex in the US, right? So they're like, oh, I really want to have a girl. And they choose the girl embryo. So from that perspective, you know, it seems crazy to say to parents, well, no, you can't choose the embryo at lowest risk for schizophrenia or bipolar or of having a birth defect. I mean, we already opened the door. We said that, you know, you can select on the basis of something as you know, as silly as sex. I mean, I don't think it's fine. People can do that. But the point is that's already been accepted and people have been doing that for years. And maybe even more trivial than that, people select embryos based on morphology. So morphology means you look at a photo of the embryo on day 5 and look at this shape of the shells, and they say, okay, this is a 5AA, whatever, some high grade or low grade. And why should the picture of what your cells look like at day 5 determine, you know, which embryo gets
It's fired? Like going to the wine shop and be like, I like that label. I know nothing about wine, but like, you could tell me whatever you want about that bottle of wine. I like the label. I'm going to buy that one.
Yeah. So I would think, honestly, that conservatives should be really excited about it, because actually it'll lead to much fewer abortions, right? Because right now people are terminating pregnancies because they find out that, you know, the child has a, you know, severe genetic anomaly. Again, you can only test for a very, very small fraction of them during that 10 weeks of gestation, but people are already terminating on that basis. So if you screen your embryos, you know about all that information before you're even pregnant, before the embryo is even transferred. So you're avoiding termination. So whichever side of the debate that you're on, whether you are pro-choice or not, I mean, everyone can appreciate that there is a physical and emotional toll on a termination, and you want to avoid them when you can. So basically, if people are, you know, en masse screening embryos, then you're avoiding a massive amount of termination for the folks who, you know, wanted to carry that pregnancy to term. And you're also avoiding, you know, a huge amount of disease, right? We're spending currently, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars on folks that we will never be able to come up with a cure for, right? There's literally no funding going into it. Yeah, I don't see how that's more humane to say that, you know, we don't have the resources to actually solve your problem or to help those families, but we're going to somehow stigmatize, you know, you're on the hook for a lifetime of medical bills, and we're going to somehow stigmatize that. I mean, I don't know. It doesn't make sense. America's like pro-freedom and pro-choice. And the main place that's the most intimate for you to exercise that is, who do you choose for your partner? How many kids do you choose to have? You know, and then which embryo, which genetic material you transfer into your own body? I don't know. It feels weird to me that the government or someone would try to get involved in that. I mean, obviously, like folks like us, we should have to hit an extremely high standard. Like the data quality and the validity is incredibly important, right? Like the quality of our results are determining, an extremely important decision. But in terms of censorship of that information, I guess we'll see. We'll see what Americans say.
I see a Supreme Court case somewhere in the future, in the next 10 years. As you say, not necessarily because it makes sense to you or I, but I just think, as you say, we're in the land of the free, except when it comes to a woman's body. We're just the land of contradictions.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like people have been, pretty warm and pretty accepting about it. But, I agree. There's always a fringe of society that you can activate that's, you know, upset about everything, whatever the new street sign or whatever innocuous thing is going on. But just super excited to be giving parents more choice and autonomy and a little bit more confidence going into, you know, an important decision.
2074, 50 years from now, is this the way we have kids? Like the kind of the default way.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I think there's like way more upgrades than that. Hopefully, you know, you have, it's affordable. It's for everyone. Hopefully you have some, you know, artificial wombs too. You know, everyone can, basically have as many kids as they want. And there's not this concern of, there's women who, you know, their uteruses don't work, or who have extremely painful pregnancies, right? There's people who end up in the hospital. So I think hopefully we'll be spending, you know, a ton of money on making sure that everyone who wants to have a healthy baby has the maximum chance of being able to do that. So hopefully it'll go far beyond, you know, just being able to screen your embryos, but hopefully we'll be able to help, you know, so many other people with so many other problems around having kids.
And that is all the time we have. I want to thank Noor for taking the time. I want to thank you all for the ratings, for the reviews, for telling your friends, for telling your neighbors about this podcast. I'd be fascinated to hear anybody's feedback about this technology. Orchid is not alone. We've actually had one of their rivals on this pod probably a year, 2 years ago now, maybe a year and a half. So this is coming. The question is, you know, how pervasive will it become? How affordable will it become? How good is the actual technology? Obviously, we don't know that for decades. But lots of big questions and, you know, obviously very interesting times. So that is it for me this week. I hope you guys enjoyed it and gave you something to think about. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you very soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.